Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey Dan, happy St. Patrick's Day. I see you're wearing green, just like me.
I am, yes. What am I? I got two. It's green and it's math because it's also Pi Day we just had.
Right.
Awesome. You're getting two for one with me.
Yeah. Are we going to talk both about Irish originating monsters and magic items and such, as well as pie related magic items?
Well, now we might. I wasn't planning on that, but yeah, now you might be connected to the improvisational topic. Yes. Sure.
Excellent. I'm we're pie. Live. Time to go. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. Today, we're going to be discussing the rich history of Irish myths and legends and stories for your D&D game. And from druids and bards to the banshees and the firbolg, what are some of the best ways to spice up your game with inspirations from the Emerald Isle and possibly some good foods to eat? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into that, a reminder as always that at the end of the show, around 2 p.m. or 2:10 Eastern time, we will be hosting our after party chat. That is a private video chat on our Discord server that is available to all our patrons. You can join in by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, you'll get an invite to our Discord server, and we'll see you there shortly after the show.
We'd love to see you there if you're not already patrons. So, Paul, we've been thinking about, you know, wanting to do an Irish mythology episode for all. We've been waiting until St. Patrick's Day actually landed on a Sunday so we can actually have it live on the show. So I'm glad we finally found that this year.
Finally.
And, of course, you know, it's very close to me. I am, you know, my family is of Irish descent, obviously. And, you know, the one time that I personally got to visit Ireland on one of my rather rare trips outside the country, I really adored it. So it's something that when I get to dig into Irish mythology and kind of bring it into my D&D games, I think that, again, you know, it's if you dig into the actualness, the players will be kind of surprised by some of the details and it kind of comes off as fresh. And I think that has improved my D&D games quite a bit.
I unfortunately have never been to Ireland, Dan, and have no Irish ancestry, although I do actually have some Scottish ancestry, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave. Good luck. Sorry. No, in fact...
Now, when I have to leave, I won't give you any heads up. I'll just step out of the frame and you won't know what happened. Yeah, the old Irish goodbye.
Excellent. You know, this is such a stupid anecdote, but I feel like I want to bring this up. When I think about Irish mythology or Celtic influence on old school D&D, the first name that pops to my mind is Tim Cask. I don't know if there's a connection there or not. I don't know what his ancestry is, honestly. But there was a time when he was regularly attending TotalCon, and I got to play quite a few OD&D games with him. This was probably about 10 or 15 years ago at this point. But I remember his character sheets had Celtic knotwork on them. He always had notebooks that were like green with Celtic symbols on it. It was definitely an area that was important to him or you know, that he felt was, you know, I don't know if it was like self-identification or if he, you know, was borrowing stuff from his home campaign, which had Celtic influence on it. But clearly, it was an interesting sign that kind of mythology must have had an influence on early D&D.
Definitely. And just in case any of our viewers don't know who Tim Cask is, of course, he's TSR that made D&D shortly, just about 50 years ago, frankly, right after the original books were released. And because he wrote a harshly critical letter to Gary Gygax saying the formatting of your book sucks and you need a professional editor. And Tim was brought on at, okay, well then now you're the guy. And Tim was the editor of all, starting with the original D&D supplements, and he was the original editor of Dragon Magazine, and tasked with organizing Dave Arneson's bushel basket of random note thoughts into an actual book once or twice. So, and we've had Tim on in the past, and he's a wonderful DM and a wonderful speaker.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's got me thinking about like early OD&D. Like, where's the first point, Dan, where we see, Celtic influence or our Irish mythology showing up in D&D? Like, my brain at first wanted to go towards like I'm assuming that the early, gosh, I want to say deities and demigods, but what was the supplement to original
gods, demigods, and heroes is the supplement gods, for original D&D. Gods, demigods, and heroes.
Which I'm sure has Irish mythology in it, but I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't earlier reference than that.
It's surprisingly thin. It's actually, in the original D&D books published again in 1974, 50 years ago, the roster of monsters was only two digest pages. It wasn't super large. There was a lot of Tolkien stuff. There was a lot of Greek stuff. And to my knowledge, there wasn't actually any specifically Irish monsters. The one thing in the original books is that on your top level, highest powered spell list, which was only sixth level, there's a spell called Gaius. And that that's an Irish word, comes directly out of Irish mythology, and has a very fundamental, essential power and way of shaping those myths, actually. The way that certain characters begin and end is really tied into their Gaius. And so you do, among the six or seven top level spells, including death spell and control weather and end all magic, there's this Gaia spell that inevitably forces the person you cast it on to follow your direction, and they absolutely cannot avoid that command on pain of death. And those mechanics vary between different editions, but for me, I grab onto that Gaia spell as the first thing, and I really try to commit. I mean, you have been victim of a Gaia spell in my games in the past, Paul, and I really try to commit to that as being something really earth-shaking on the same level as Disintegrate or a mass death spell. That's going to change your life, inevitably. And there's no way around it. Once you have a Gaia spell, Dispel won't work. Remove Curse won't work. There's no way to avoid it.
And do you know the mythological origin of that?
So I have next to me, I hear a translation of the Ulster myth cycle, which is called the Tarn Bo Cúilnge. Translated would be the cattle raid of Cúile, which is the mythology of the Cúchulainn character. And so maybe in a couple minutes, I don't want to derail us too much, but the story of Cúchulainn and his battles and his life is very much tied into his Gaius.
Fascinating. All right.
So maybe we'll talk about that. Maybe I'll talk about him a little bit later. But yeah, it's absolutely an unavoidable thread of the primary Irish pre-Christian mythology.
So what do you want to dig into? Yeah, go for it.
Okay, well, let's talk about other spells. Okay, so there aren't a whole lot of spells in D&D that you can point to, but one thing in first edition, you go forward a little bit and you have a druidical spell called Shillelagh, and it basically gives you a magical staff to fight with. And the funny thing is that my grandfather, who I'm partly named after, named Roland Collins, I grew up in close contact just down the road and was working with my grandfather all the time. Initially, early on, owned and ran a lumber mill and was a farmer. And so when he would get angry or frustrated with any of us grandkids, he would threaten, like, I'm going to go grab my shillelagh is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go into the barn. I'm going to grab my shillelagh. I'm going to give you a licking. Now, he didn't literally have a shillelagh. He never actually laid a hand on any of us. But apparently in his cultural idiom, he had this, like, I'm going to threaten you with a shillelagh. And the funny thing is, I didn't really, you know, I didn't know Celtic language. And so when I got a D&D book and I saw this, I couldn't match up the spelling with what he was saying. So for a rather embarrassingly long amount of time, I didn't know that this H-I-L-L-E-G-A-H word was what my grandfather was threatening us with all these years, was a shillelagh. But it was several years later, I was like, oh, wait a minute, that's what he was saying all the time.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it is. It is one of those words, I'm sure, that, you know, I mean, we have a litany of these words, Dan, that of like words that we're used to seeing in print, but never really like had to speak out loud. Or if we did, certainly didn't have anyone to tell us how the heck they were pronounced. Heck, even
it's one of the rare cases like where I got that in reverse, is I knew what it sounded like and I didn't know how to, I didn't know what it looked like on the page.
Yeah. I was looking at the text you put in for the introduction to this video and couldn't help but notice the large preponderance of extra accents and, that kind of like symbology. What was the word I'm looking for here?
Diacritical marks?
Diacritical marks, sure. Which I feel like in the 90s was like all over fantasy literature everywhere. Everybody wanted to make character names,
yes,
and world names, yes, just like lots of hyphens, right, and apostrophes. And is that where that's coming
from?
Is that the Gaelic influence?
Partly, sure, absolutely, partly. And if you do that, I think you got to go real light with it. My thesis currently is you can have three words like that in your book. You can have three, right, and they have to be significant, important concepts that are important to the story. You get three italicized words like that. Don't do it all the time. Because frankly, even preparing for this show, I would love to pronounce all the words correctly. I'm not going to do it. I had time to research, to look up a couple, so I can say things like, I believe I can say Cucullin properly. And I believe I know I can say shillelagh right, because I grew up with that. And I think I can say Cunha right. And other than that, I'm probably going to be like, just guessing. Gaius, right? I think I know how to say Gaius right now, even though I did that wrong for many years. And that, other than that, I'm more or less guessing. Apologies if I don't get stuff right.
Yeah.
Now, like right now, okay, so we're debating it in the chat, right? So Kilroy, thank you so much. So Kilroy's understanding is that what I'm calling Gaius should be called Gesh. So I might be misremembering the last time I looked it up, and I apologize for that.
No. So, sorry, I got us a little off track here. We were talking about spells that have Irish mythological influence.
Yeah, and one other thing I'll point out is the in my OED branded classic D&D games, there's a couple spells in my book of spells that I adjust a little bit from normal D&D concepts, and one of them is the invisibility spell. And partly where I get that from, what I don't like about classic D&D invisibility is, oh, you're invisible. Also, like the mass invisibility spell or something like that. And now you can't see yourself. Ha ha. Where do you have your stuff in your backpack? Well, you don't know because it's all invisible and you can't see it. And your whole party's invisible. And ha ha. Now you're like the Keystone Cops bumping into each other because you can't see each other. You're bumping into each other. Wonderful. Right. But in classic legends, that's not a thing. In particular, like the classic gods of Ireland are very notable for traveling in a magical mist that no one can see through. And it's not like they can't see themselves, but they have this misty barrier from which mortal eyes can't see through them, and they're perfectly fine. You also see this, frankly, in Homeric works. The Greek gods also travel or, defend their favorite heroes in a magical mist. And it's not like, and this happens to Odysseus, and it's not like they can't see themselves and they have these comical things. Invisibility is great. There's no downside to it, to you. So my interpretation of invisibility for D&D that I have in Book of Spells is just like Irish myth of, it's basically a magical mist and you actually can see yourself. Other people can't see in. And for me, that clears up a lot of problems, and it kind of removes this cartoonish comedy element. Mm. And I probably wouldn't have thought to do that if I hadn't read that kind of thing in Irish legends.
That's fascinating. Is the mist itself visible? Is it just like an obscuring, like, oh, here comes a cloud rolling in? Or is the idea that the mist itself is not visible to other people?
That's how I read it. That's how I read it. The mist cannot be seen by mortal eyes, but from the inside, that's what you can kind of see through it, is my interpretation. I'm sure other people can interpret different ways, but that's how I take it.
That's great. Certainly, the original description of the spell doesn't really... Yeah, right.
You know, one of the nice things in original D&D is that they're so short that it assumes you're bringing your understanding from mythology into the game, and different, you know, DMs can interpret a taste or at different times. And as you go into the advanced D&D project, then things get much longer and they try to spell all this stuff out, and some of the magic goes away, frankly.
I mean, it sounds like, frankly, you know, again, as I was trying to think of like the earliest appearances of this stuff and going to the gods, demigods and heroes book, like, yeah, there's clearly a whole section there of like gods from Celtic mythology. But frankly, I've always had a problem with that supplement because I'm like, how am I exactly supposed to use this thing? Exactly. What am I supposed to put my players on quests to go destroy the gods? Why do I want stats for gods of different mythologies?
Well, that's fair. I have a snapshot of like the first page where that appears, right? So yeah, so in the fourth supplement to original D&D, which is Gods, Demigods, and Heroes, the Celtic deities, again pre-Christian, are totally in there, right? Along with sometimes that book's hard to find because the mythos lists aren't in alphabetical order or any order, and there's no table of contents or index. So you have to remember what's in there and just flip randomly around and find it. But there's Egyptian mythos, and there's Greek mythos, and there's Robert Howard's Conan stuff is in there. And there's also the Celtic mythos. And, so we always have this debate about what the book's for and why they have stats. And frankly, the foreword of the book does say, this is going to show how overwhelmingly powerful the gods are, and your very frail original D&D characters can't possibly hold a candle to them, and this should be a lesson to your players. Now, of course, the very next thing is some DM said, but I allow my players to be 50th level, and they can do this, and that, of course, beat the whole premise of the book at the time. But you do have pre-Christian deities like Dagda here, there's Sylvanus, the wood deity, there's Maeve, the war goddess. They do have stats for Cú Chulainn. And I will point out that in Irish myth, there is a great monster that's listed here named the Balor, is where that word comes from. And of course, in this work, that is a formerly titanic-sized monster that's been decapitated and is currently reduced to merely a 30-foot-tall head with death vision. And in this very reduced weak state compared to what it used to be, but that is, the Balor is a monster from the Celtic mythos.
Fascinating.
Right? Now, the other thing gets tied in to the Celtic mythos, and here on this page they're pointing out, you know, of course Celtic culture was initially all through Europe before the Roman Empire started to take over, but it lasted the longest in Ireland, which obviously is the very far tip of the Irish area, of the European area, and was never conquered by Romans. So Celtic pagan stuff lasted in Ireland longer than anywhere else, which is why we kind of think about it like that, is that the Celtic mythos is also very closely tied into Druids. And even though the original D&D books didn't have Druids, they came in the supplements pretty soon. And in the first edition Deities and Demigods book, it specifically says clerics of most of these deities are Druids. So the assumption is that Celtic priests are basically always druids as of around first edition D&D, which I think is an interesting detail. Tend to be a lot of nature-oriented D&D deities. You know, at the time, if we're thinking like Bronze Age, there aren't cities. There isn't an elaborate, complicated social structure. So the deities tend to be very nature-oriented, and it kind of makes sense. And the druids were, you know, an important part of the ruling class of pre-Christian Ireland. So it kind of makes sense that they're very tied in together like that.
I can't help but notice, in fact, that there is an entry in Gods, Demigods, and Heroes in this Celtic section that says druids. And it says druids. For an excellent description of these beings, see Eldritch Wizardry, Supplement 3.
Totally, right. And so, you know, it's interesting because I think in, what was it? It was like Supplement 2. Oh my God. Okay, so I think in Supplement 1, Greyhawk, the druids appeared in the monster list. Like they were just NPC monsters. And then in Supplement 3, they were like, oh, well, maybe you'd like to try them as player characters. That's an option as of Supplement 3. And then here in Supplement 4, they're an intrinsic important part of the campaign because of the way they tie into the Celtic mythos. So it's one of those interesting transitions, again, of like, you know, here's a ferocious, you know, monster that can't possibly be a player character. And then immediately, well, obviously, I want to play that as my player character. And the game evolves in that direction over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, that's very classic. Classic bloat problem, right? In this game we played
right
all these years. I don't know. I certainly experienced that in the mid-90s when suddenly all my players wanted to play Drow.
There you
Thanks,
go.
Bob.
There you go. And then it was and then it was tieflings, and now we're on to some other stuff at this point.
Yeah, of course.
So, well, it used to be. Well, kids, the first time that happened, it was druids.
There you go. So, shall we discuss druids, Dan? Can we do an episode?
Well, I think we should table that for another episode, possibly, because I feel I don't want to derail us with that with it being a too big thing. But I will also point out that because we did do previously in season 3, we did do a show on bards, and the bardic concept also comes out of Irish legends. And just to recap a little bit, in first edition D&D, right, bards were this separate special superclass that was put in an appendix. And in order to become a bard, you had to have a whole career as fighters. And then you had to have a whole career to a fairly high level as thieves. And then you had to switch. And I'll just quote from the first edition book here. It says, and then you have to leave off the thieving and begin clerical studies as druids. And at this time, they are actually bards under druidical tutelage. So, As I pointed out in our bards episode, right, the bards of Irish myth weren't funny comical relief minstrels, right? They were roaming lawgivers. They were second only to kings, and they were basically like ancient Judge Dredds. Basically, they had all the power. They had all the laws in their head. Basically, they were the law, and they had the power and the capacity to roam around and defend the people and take down any supervillains that existed. And I think that's what first edition D&D is saying with all that stuff, is that the bards are this super powerful class. They have all the knowledge, having been trained by druids and getting druidical magic. And for more, you can go back in that season 3 episode and see what we said about bards. But yeah, I don't mind bards being these uber powerful Judge Dredd characters, because that's how they appear in classic ancient Irish myth.
It's come a long way. It's fascinating to see them go through that transformation.
Right.
Dan, I've never encountered these myths where they're portrayed in that way. If I was a DM who's interested in incorporating that into my campaign, where should I look?
I believe I have a resource list in that prior show that I was okay. pointing Great. Out. And I had to do some digging into the original Irish myth, but I will refer our viewers to that season 3, episode 25.
Awesome. Worth checking out. All right, can we talk about monsters? Because I feel like that's really where we're going to start to see more Irish mythology.
I would love to talk about monsters. Changed.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't know. When I think about Irish mythology monsters, my brain immediately goes to the leprechaun, which we have talked about. Should we do an episode on leprechauns? Should we do an episode, a whole episode, Dan, on leprechauns? Is there enough topic there?
I'm confident now that there is, Paul. I'm sure that we could do a whole episode on leprechauns. But let's breach it just a little bit now.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I swear this is not the first time I've put this image up. Were we talking about leprechauns in the Bard episode? I think we've looked at this before, Dan.
I think we
Certainly
have.
Delighted I think over we the have. Fascination of the fact that the leprechauns are mucking with the actual format of the book. Look, one of them's up there stealing the little header. It's just so delightful. What a delightful piece of artwork. This is from, I think, first edition AD&D Monster Manual.
100%.
Delightful. Yep, exactly. Who did this art? It's just perfect.
I totally agree. And it's totally unique. There's nothing like this in the entire book of the monster actually breaking out of the frame and doing various bits of sabotage on the book itself. And they're stealing the header. And they've perched themselves on the title, and I snipped it off. But there's another monster off to the left that they're messing with. There's a giant leech monster that one of them's grabbed onto and riding around off to the side. So they've completely broken out of the entire structure and are just roaming around the book, doing rather various bits of sabotage. So, and there's nothing else like that. And I really kind of adore that. And I've actually had a fairly good scenes of leprechauns trying to trick the players. And it's something that you get a lot of. You're not going to fight them almost surely. You get this is a great opportunity for negotiation and role playing. And if you do play them as fundamentally like beyond the rules, and you can't beat them with a spell and you can't beat them with a sword, you have no choice but to negotiate with them. That's a really nice piece of like classic D&D play to break your players out of nothing on your character sheet's going to help you because they're just outside the rules and you just have to negotiate with them on their own terms. And that's some really interesting special stuff that starts happening.
I mean, I love how that is communicated in the artwork. That is absolutely delightful. I can't say that I've ever tried to use these in my campaign in that way. It sounds like a lot of fun, but it also is. I'm surprised at like how open ended this is, especially for AD&D, right? AD&D, where they're trying to buckle down rules for every little thing. You have so much open to interpretation here in this description, right? You have things like it tells us if they're caught or discovered in a slayer, the leprechaun will attempt to mislead its captor into believing he is giving over his treasure while he is actually duping the captor. And note, leprechauns have a great fondness for wine, and this weakness may be used to outwit them. Like, that's a very kind of, just open-ended little hints of, like, how you're supposed to use these in-game that have nothing to do with stats, right? That are just, like, really,
exactly.
Really DM. Please, DM, play up the mischievous nature of these creatures.
Exactly. And I've said it before, but let me just tell you how that last line came into play in my game at one point. The leprechauns have a great fondness for wine, and this weakness may be used to outwit them. So I think I had a leprechaun that knew where there was a dungeon or a treasure or something like that. And he said, I would adore a container of wine. I will tell you what you want to know, but only if you give me a drink of wine. And only if you give me a wine. And so the player went, yes. And normally they played a very serious character. And they said, yes, I agree to your terms. And here is your wine. I'm cold. I'm hungry. I want to go home. My feet hurt. There, sir, is your wine.
Did it work?
Of course I said yes to that. Yes. Of course I said yes to that.
That's hilarious.
Now maybe not. You don't try it a second time, player. Just to be alert to any of my players. Just it's not going to work a second time.
Clearly not.
Once it worked once.
And I can't help but notice that the actual last line of text in the description here says that rumor has it leprechauns are a species of halfling with a strong strain of pixie. Why?
Okay, so they were really into that, right? So that's why, so they were really into this like racial hierarchy of classic monsters, and we don't need to literally use that, but
I like to think that somewhere in the TSR headquarters, someone had a big poster on their wall of like the genealogy of the monsters. And was tracing all their origins back to dinosaurs, which are clearly in the manual as well. So, ultimately, I suppose pixies are derived from the early mammalian life, or I don't know what.
Well, you can trace this back to
one of that line.
No. But you can trace this like this is very similar to August Derleth's interaction with H.P. Lovecraft's work. Like Lovecraft wrote a bunch of crazy stuff, and then later authors come through and go like, we kind of don't like this chaotic universe. We're going to try to put some kind of organization to it and explain why all these multiform things exist with some kind of family tree. And so, there's an original chaotic creator, and then there's usually a second person later on that tries to put some kind of structure on it to explain all this stuff. And that's a little taste of that happening right there, I think.
That's hilarious. Hilarious. All right. Leprechauns. Let's move on. What other monster do you want to talk about here? I feel like we have a couple.
Well, interestingly, okay. So I think of the Banshee. Like, frankly, even before leprechauns, for me, I think of the Banshee as like a top level, really horrible monster. Interestingly, it was a little tough for me to find that in the AD&D Monster Manual this morning because it's not under Banshee. It's listed under Groaning Spirit. and this first line, great art by Dave Trampier. And the first line has always stuck in my head. I mean, I'm a kid. I get this. I don't think I'm 10 years old yet. And I flip through this, and I love this first line. And again, this also bears on this same kind of genealogy of where the monsters come from. Is it says the groaning spirit or banshee is the spirit of an evil female elf, a very rare thing indeed. And not being jaded. Right. That really hit me. It's like, oh, yes, elves. So rare. Women elves. I've never heard of that. Evil elves. Unthinkable. And one's comeback is undead. Yes. A very rare thing indeed. And boy, I really took that to heart and believed it. It's funny nowadays, how much more jaded we are with like elves. Everybody's seen like all kinds of elves. But this really hit me hard. And again, it's one of like the worst. It's one of the added undead figures. And it's one of the worst things ever because it has the moaning, the wail, which is just a death spell. So it does its wail, and here's within 3 inches, must save versus magic or die on the spot. You get one save or die. And that's fairly scary.
It is, right? I mean, you also have your save or fear effect just by seeing them, right? They're pretty terrifying, mm-hmm. terrifying monsters. Just by those stats, it is interesting,
right?
The whole unusual nature of elves being turned into undead, I think, is fascinating. I'm trying to remember I know that elves presumably can't catch lycanthropy, right? That they just die. They just wither away if they are, bitten by a lycanthrope. Are there similar effects here with other undead where we expect elves to not? Are there elven vampires? Are there elven ghouls? I never really stopped to think about this, and now I kind of want to know. Now I'm like fascinated. Right? Maybe I want all kinds of elven undead.
I think that's a place where a lot of the time in the early game, it's not spelled out because people hadn't thought about it. But and I think that's a great opportunity for the individual DM to fill that in for their campaign. if that works differently for different species types of characters, I think that's great. It's going to surprise your players, and I think that's a really awesome opportunity to fill that in specifically for the DM's taste.
Yeah, fascinating.
So maybe some undead are only possibly the results of certain racial types being cursed or dead. And I think that's a I think that's a really interesting piece of flavor, frankly.
So what, Dan, what do you know about the mythological origin of the Banshee?
I'm a little, I'm a little shaken, but that is clearly an Irish monster, and they are known for their wailing. They are, it is true that they're also known as the groaning spirit. And there was a recent movie, right, that used that in the title, right? The Banshees of Inisherin, I think. So, yes, I'll let our viewers, you can read up on the mythological Banshee if you want, and see what direction, again, see what direction you want to take it or twist it in your game.
Huh. Dan, interesting comment here from one of our viewers. I want to throw up onto the screen real quick.
I hope it's Jerry's.
Jerry McDonald asks, shouldn't the Vault of the Drow be chock full of Banshees? I mean, I've not run it, but you have. Is it chock full of Banshees? Should it be?
I love that comment from Jerry. That's a great observation, and that seems to be a gap. I don't think there are any Banshees in the Vault of Drow. Now I think there should be. That's a great point.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of other undead. There's ghouls and there's vampires and all kinds of stuff like that. You're right. There should be a lot of Banshees. Maybe that was a known problem, and the Drow had to take care of it somehow. Maybe they knew to deal with it, but that's a great point that we should use to fill in. Actually, thanks, Jerry.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering, like, if a banshee must be the spirit of an evil female elf, then yeah, the drow seem like the obvious direction for
that's the entire ruling class,
right?
The entire ruling class.
Do they all turn into banshees?
If falls in that description, is it there? It's not a rare thing at all. That's your customary social structure is that. Now, Joshua was saying Lolth has them all. Lolth has just taken them all as her henchmen. And I actually do think that there's a Banshee somewhere in the Lolth adventure, actually. Queen of the Demon Web Pits. Just one, if I recall correctly. That's a really good point. Good point, everybody.
I feel like... Yeah. For me, let me go back. Let me ask you, Dan. Have you used the Banshee in any of your games?
I don't think I have in a way that I've placed. I think I've had one or two adventures where they were potentially in the mix, and I don't think I've placed one. Again, this came out in first edition, so if I stick to original D&D, it's not directly in my line of sight to think about the Banshees, and maybe I should bring them in places.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what adventure. I feel like there's definitely an adventure I've run that had a Banshee in it. I almost kind of want it to be Dyson's Delve, but we streamed that, so you would remember it.
Right.
So, but I feel like with Banshees, the right way to play this, and I'm pretty sure the way it came up in my own campaign is to give some kind of hint about their existence.
Yeah.
Right. If the players are anticipating Banshees, then the sudden appearance of one is way more horrifying, right? I think you need that moment of, oh no, it's going to scream. We're all going to die. Right. We need to get the heck out of here.
Right. And I think it's a good, and this, I might, maybe this is starting to come back to me a little bit. And I think another place of these like top level threats, again, it's an intelligent creature, right? It's like right here, it says intelligence exceptional. It's not a mindless, all I know is to, you know, eat brains undead. So it's another opportunity to bring some negotiation role-playing into the game. And if the Banshee has some sort of goal or some sort of, you know, motivation or intent, they can come and they can negotiate with your players of like, you need to go get me a whatever. You need to go get me this MacGuffin. And if you don't, I'm going to scream right now and you're all going to have to save versus death. And that gives quite a lot of negotiating power, I feel. So that's kind of an interesting, legitimately scary thing. It's maybe, you know, I don't mind level drain for the classic undead as an element that is scary, but here you have the opportunity for something where the threat's on the table, right? It's sort of a Chekhov's gun type situation without necessarily having to immediately just jump your players with the save or die. You could say that. You could say, I need you to do this for me. And if you don't, I am a banshee and I have my wailing power and it will cause instant irrevocable death. So, you know, you choose. I'm giving you options.
I love the very calm delivery that you're giving for this, Dan. I feel like if I was role playing a banshee, I would want to give them a personality that is maybe a bit more childish, right? Where they're going to have a tantrum. I'm going to scream.
Oh, yes. Okay. All right. Yes. That was a different direction I expected. Yes. Do that. Yes. Right. That's good. Just slightly out of control. Out of control.
I don't get my way.
Then everyone's.
I had a friend, but then they just killed over dead, and I'm so angry about it.
I could just scream.
I could just yell. Yeah. Oh, right. Beautiful. Yeah. So this is good. And a powerful, intelligent, undead creature, right, that you can totally use for these kinds of interesting role-playing opportunities. That's good stuff. Yeah. Let me tell you, there's another monster. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I was just wondering if there was a Banshee and Pool of Radiance. Was there a Banshee and Pool of Radiance, maybe? Remember that from your playthrough?
Oh boy. I think when I got hit with the graphic, I think of a specter, I was guessing that. I think I was like, oh, specter or a banshee. Either way, it's not great.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
I think. So here's another move forward a little bit and you'll get to the Monster Manual 2 that came out in the 80s, mostly written by Gary Gygax. And you get some additional Irish type monsters. For example, there's the Bodak, and that's been a core D&D monster ever since. And so the Bodak is a human who was changed into a monster after venturing somewhere on the Abyssal Plains. And so they basically, these are not super intelligent types. They have low intelligence. These are basically monster. And here's the primary thing about the Bodak is that they have a death gaze. They look at you and you have to save, you're instantly dead. So generally speaking, the Irish monsters aren't messing around a whole lot. There's a whole lot of save or die powers because here's a little side point, right? So my partner Isabel and I, right, we're looking for TV or movies, right? And this has been going on for years, right? And there could be like a TV show or movie that was, you know, made in Ireland or possibly, you know, Irish produced or something like that. And frequently they're marketed as this is, you know, an Irish comedy. And we start watching it and we go, this is horrifically dark. this is so appalling. The thing is violence, and there's assaults of various types, and like we frequently can't get through it. But the media companies have no way of marketing Irish sensibility media other than, oh, it's a dark comedy. It's an Irish dark comedy. It's like, it's not, they're all, anytime you see Irish dark comedy marketed, it's a horror story. right? And it doesn't have to be monsters. It doesn't have to be ghosts, right? It's just like, sometimes we have my people have a slightly dark look on the world, frankly. The Irish mythology monsters, when they come into D, frequently are just like save or die, because that's probably what stuff is like.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it fits. I think I not too long ago watched Derry Girls, which of course is all set during open conflict happening in Ireland. That's And it's comedic, but like also, you know, arm checkpoints. I don't know.
All right. If I said this, okay, you're forcing me. I'm sorry. Okay, here's the anecdote. So Isabel and I visit Ireland, right? A couple of years ago. And we're in Belfast, which is kind of close to where my ancestral family initially comes from, right? And we are talking to some lovely tour guides in a bar the first night we get there, and they're like, "Oh yeah, it's wonderful, Belfast, very safe, and you almost never have to worry about the peace walls." And we're like, "The what now? The who?" And so Belfast is, since the 70s or 80s, is divided up by a bunch of 40-foot tall concrete bunkers between the different ethnic neighborhoods, and they have these big gates between them that in times of trouble will be shut off to just seal off the various neighborhoods. And so one night we're walking around as on our own, the two of us, and we travel from our hotel into one neighborhood, and we pass through into another neighborhood through one of these peace gates, and they're wide open and there's almost no traffic. And we're like walking around, we're like, "Gee, I wonder when the last time that was used was. I'm thinking like maybe 10 years ago. I mean, there aren't big problems nowadays." And we walk several blocks around and we're chatting about this. "Oh, I wonder, you know, the peace gates were probably last used maybe 10 years ago is what I'm guessing." And we come around a corner and I finish that sentence with, "Or maybe 5 minutes ago," because the gate is, because the gate has been sealed for the night.
No.
In the time that we're walking around in a different neighborhood, and there's like an empty lot, like maybe something is burned down previously, and we're like, "We don't know how to get back. We're in Belfast at night. Now it's dark, and we don't know how to get back to the city center and get back to our hotel." Mm-hmm. And we're like, "What are we gonna do?" And now a black tinted window SUV starts slowly coming down. There's no one else around, and a black big SUV comes rolling down the street very slowly, right? Mm-hmm. up the street, stops right next to us. The window rolls down, and a guy leans out the window and goes, "How are you liking the troubles?"
Oh God!
No. And we're like, we don't know. We don't. And he offers to direct us back to this to tell us how to get back because we're not actually sealed in or anything like that. And helps us out a lot. But there was the attitude of like, "I'm going to make a joke at these terrified tourists that think they're currently trapped," about our violent troubled past in this city. Like, "So how are the troubles doing for you?"
That's delightful. That's delightful. I mean, honestly, I feel like I absolutely want to include this in my D&D campaign. I need a city that's just full of peace gates. And people who are just very nonchalant about it. That's delightful.
Right? That would be very Irish.
Yeah.
Okay, now I see we're about to run out of time, and I had a lot more to say. So let me touch back to the question about Gaius's at the start. And I love that I got an opportunity to read the Irish mythology called the Tarn Bulchuna, which is mostly about Cú Chulainn. And two things I want to point out there, right? So Cú Chulainn, who is basically a superhero, right? Some kind of demi, you know, on the order of like Hercules, basically. Mm-hmm. And Cú Chulainn is basically a one-man army. So the evil queen tries to take over his nation's territory and cattle, and due to a curse, all the other warrior men of the land are cursed by having a period, frankly, in order to experience what women go through. They've been cursed with an incapacitating period during this time, and none of the other men can actually function. So Cú Chulainn has to go out and single-handedly battle the whole other army to a standstill for several weeks until the rest of the army can be raised. And so among the things that you get there is that his training involved learning a whole bunch of feats. So the idea of fighters having a bunch of special maneuvers that we call feats comes directly out of the Irish mythology. And I'm just going to read this. I'm going to grab this and kind of read the paragraph of his training before the actual epic starts. And it says here, so Cuchulainn's training with Scathach in the craft of arms was done. What with the apple feet, juggling nine apples with never more than one in his palm, the thunder feet, the feats of the sword edge and the sloped shield, the feats of the javelin and the rope, the body feat, the feat of cat, and the heroic salmon leap, the pole throw and the leap over a poisoned stroke, the noble chariot fighter's crouch, the guy bolga, the spurt of speed, the feat of the chariot wheel thrown on high, and the feat of the shield rim, the breath feat with golden apples blown up into the air, the snapping mouth and the hero's scream, the stroke of precision, the stunning shot and the cry stroke, stepping on a lance in flight and straightening erect on its point, the sickle chariot, and the trussing of a warrior on the points of spears. So Cuchulainn knew a whole bunch of feats, and you know that's become very fundamental since like third edition D&D, and fifth edition's kind of danced around, maybe you want to use feats, and I think in the revision now that's like a core necessity that you have for your player characters. So that's an interesting point. And the other point is the idea of a gaius. Is Cuchulainn had, as part of his training, he took a couple oaths that we would call a gaius that, again, were unbreakable. And the idea was by making these oaths of things that he was definitely going to do or not going to do, he gained additional power from it. So so he made an oath. Among his oaths was he was never going to eat dog meat, because the name Cuchulainn actually means the cur, the hound of Culan. As almost a young infant, he came up to an armed stronghold, was attacked by their guard dogs, and single-handedly broke the necks of all the guard dogs. And then the master was very sad, and he offered to be, I will be your replacement hound. I will be your replacement guard dog until you can raise new guard dogs, and lived in the doghouse, literally, with the other dogs. You know, kind of like a raised by wolves type situation. So the name Cur of Culan actually means the dog of Culan. So he was he had a gaius to never eat dog meat of his effective kindred, and he also had a gaius to never refuse hospitality. So the problem is how those two things interact. And ultimately, when his enemies became determined to finish him off, they trapped him by having an old lady offer him a meal of dog meat. And he could neither decline the offer of a meal, nor could he eat the dog meat. So one way or the other, he had to break a gaius, and that took away his superpower, weakened him for his final battle, which ultimately was his doom. So when I have and unfortunately, you know, sadly, he also in the myth, Cuchulainn also slew his own son, because likewise his son had taken an oath to never reveal his identity as Cuchulainn's son, and also to never back down from a fight. So he comes up to Cuchulainn's camp at night. Cuchulainn can't recognize him, says, "Tell me who you are." And Culna says, "Never." And Cuchulainn says, "Well, then I will battle you." And the son says, I can't withdraw from that. And then morning comes, and it turns out that sadly he's slain his own son, unfortunately. So when I bring gaiuses, so my point is, when I bring gaiuses into my D&D games, and this surprises players in a nice place, you also get some kind of additional power. So when in my campaign, when a character did have a gaius to go on a particular quest, it also raised their strength up, kind of in Cuchulainn's idea. And I feel that this is another place with these top-level spells where the DM can manipulate it in any kind of any direction they want. And so for me, gaiuses provide an unbreakable oath like that, but also some kind of additional power that you might not expect. And that's a really nice kind of twist that surprises my players in an unexpected, nice way. And I think that bringing that kind of understanding of the gaius in the game is put some additional magic in those top level spells.
Do you feel so strongly about that you want to include language for that? Will the Book of Spells include an altered Gaius that includes some language about requiring it to give some added benefit?
As some of our viewers might know, right, I have copious footnotes in the current draft, and that's one of the places where in the footnote I would encourage the DM to put their own twist on it, right? The main language I want to be, you know, simple and clear and straightforward, and then if the DM wants to put an additional twist on it in their campaign, I usually put that in a footnote to Book of Spells. And I think among the places, that's a great opportunity for, and I really highly encourage that for the top level stuff, is the top level spells in D&D should be mysterious and surprising and continually unexpected. And I think that's the place where the DM can step in and make those, tailor things to their campaign is a great opportunity. And take, you know, mythology, right? Take ideas from the cultural legends that we have. And you know, even though they're all down in these books, your players will be very surprised when you step into your game with that.
Now I can't help but think back to that time we did play a game where a character I was playing got Gaius'd, and I recall it was at our annual convention, HelgaCon, which is coming up next weekend. So I look forward to that. There should be I'm not sure what effect that has on this show. That might you might have to do something about that. Anyway, sorry. So as I recall, I played a character who at the very end of one game got hit with a Gaius. The next year we played the continuation of that game, and sure enough, that character was removed as a playable character due to being under Gaius. And I think that I ended up playing his son, I think, if I recall that correctly.
I think that's
what I ended up doing. I can't remember if that was intentionally placed in there by you or if it was something that I just created on the fly there in the moment, but now knowing all this mythology behind it, I'm kind of disappointed that it didn't end with a mortal battle between me and my father.
I was prepared. I think at the time I was prepared for that to happen. I think it was an option on the table that might have happened, actually. Yeah.
And more importantly, though, where was my superpower for being stuck under a Gaius? What the heck's with that, huh?
Surprise!
Well, I guess technically, I wasn't.
Like I say, it's always surprising, Paul. You'll never know.
All right. Well, all that aside, we are out of time. Any final thoughts, Dan, on Irish mythology's impact on early D&D?
I like taking a mythology that's slightly lesser known. Like, I think most people have studied like Greek or Roman mythology, possibly in schools. And those deities and those myths and those monsters are very well known. And I think if you dig into something that's just slightly off the beaten path, it could be Irish mythology, could be some other culture's slightly lesser prominent mythology, and you get something that has a very deep tradition that was very meaningful for people for centuries or thousands of years, and you bring that in your D&D game and you'll get that kind of depth, it won't be quite as obvious or well known to your players, and I think you'll get a very, very nice reaction. And particularly with the monsters that are intelligent, and you can have role playing opportunities that are possibly super powerful in some ways, and again, surprising and things they don't know the statistics for. I get really, really good effects out of those kinds of things.
Nice, nice. Frankly, I feel like that's the way that books like the Gods and Demigods should have gone, right? That rather than stat them, just give the background, the inspirational material for how to include those, that mythology in your game without necessarily saying, like, and here are the stats and here's how to fight them, because what inevitably you're going to push the players to do that, right? Inevitably, they're going to say, well, it's got hit points, that means I can hit it.
That's fair. That's fair.
Viewers, if you have any thoughts on Irish mythology as it is presented in D&D, cases or things that we missed in this, because there were much more on our list that we didn't get to, things that you'd like to see us cover in the future, drop us a line, put a comment here in the YouTube video, and we would love to see your thoughts, and maybe that will spin up the topic for a new show down the road.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube and Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, TikTok by the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please grab your shillelagh and hit that like button.
If you prefer to listen to us in audio-only podcast format, you can get our podcasts at wanderingdms.com or through various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those other sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And again, all of our tiers there on patreon.com get you access to our Discord server, where the conversation is continuing 24/7. And we'll be having a video after chat with our patrons there in about 10 minutes. We would love to see you there if you haven't been there before. Upcoming this week on the channel, I'll be back Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time, for more of Dan's old-time mini show, and I'll be cracking open this mold that we've been making for the Space Monkey Yazirians from the Star Frontiers game, see if that works. They have these big, thin membranes. I'm not entirely sure whether that's going to work or not, but I'm going to try that this Thursday, and then I guess our viewers will have to stay tuned on our sites to see what our schedule is for Sunday based on the fact that we've got our HouseCon coming up. Right, Paul?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. I would expect it to at least be delayed, if not possibly. We might have to take a week off for that. We'll figure it out and notify everyone on our social media and such.
We'll schedule that, and I'll know by Thursday night. So if you'll tune in Thursday night, and I'll tell you what's happening for Sunday. So so keep that in mind, and don't forget, we are live practically every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again another week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.